And good morning to you. You are listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO, here in Portland. My name is Andrew Geller, and I'm pleased to bring you an hour-long program today instead of our normal half hour, because the topic we're discussing being peak oil and the aftermath and living with peak oil is our topic. And in fact, I'm going to be speaking specifically about a book that was released about almost 2 months ago called The Long Emergency, Surviving the Convergent Catastrophes of the 21st Century. James Howard Kunstler is the author, and he is our guest this morning. Welcome to KBOO's Airwaves.
Hello, Andrew.
Hi.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, well,
nice to be anywhere, as Keith Richards once said.
Yeah, and they're going all over themselves soon.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's ironic because in the future, things like great big rock and roll tours won't be possible. But we'll get to that. So your book, The Long Emergency, is primarily about oil.
Primarily about the global energy predicament.
Well, and I was going to say, and more specifically, sort of a shortage of oil, and how to deal with the fact that never again in the history of, or in the future of humankind, will we be able to enjoy the type of energy bonanza that has existed for maybe, say, the past 160 years, 140 years, somewhere in there.
Well, I wouldn't say never. I mean, we don't really know what the human race may encounter, you know, 1,000 years from now or 300 years from now. But I'd say within the foreseeable future,
next several generations,
at least.
Okay.
And that's why I titled the book "The Long Emergency," because, you know, a lot of people accuse me of being apocalyptic, and I take issue with that label because what I'm describing is not the end of the world or even the end of civilization per se, but a discontinuity, a severe, sharp discontinuity. And that's not the same as the end of the world, of course.
Right. And it's not even the same thing as the end of oil, because the end
right.
of oil won't even happen. It's just supply is projected to trickle down to very little in the next several...
Well, I put it differently, Andrew. I mean, I'd say that, you know, the whole idea of the peak is that you're entering the slippery slope of depletion, and that there will still be a lot left, but we will be producing... you know, several percentages points less every year, and the fact that the energy supply will be contracting rather than growing or even staying stable makes all the difference in the world and is going to change everything about how we live.
Okay, so I just wanted to, and I guess that there was sort of a definition of the peak of oil production, and that's all peak oil refers to is the annual production level has hit the maximum possible, and once that point
will decline
yeah.
afterward remorselessly.
And in 1970, that happened for the United States, which I guess at the time was the largest producer globally, or certainly at the top end of it. And
we were the largest, we were the greatest oil producer for, you know, close to 120 years. We were it. And, you know, after 1970, we were not it anymore. So it was a big shock to us when that happened.
Now, you, God, I don't even remember where it was that I read this exactly. But the peak of oil production in the United States had extremely serious consequences for the U.S. economy since that time. And that has, again, I'm not sure if this is you that said this or someone else whose work I've read in preparing for the show, but the experience of the U.S. post-domestic peak has a, you know, there's foreshadowing there for the rest of the world. So could you tell us a little bit how the peak of U.S. oil production impacted its economy in, say, you know, maybe the first 10 to 15 years afterward?
Yeah, well, we're really talking about the 1970s and the great troubles and sorrows of the 1970s. It's true, the United States peaked in 1970, we were producing about 10 million barrels a day. We now produce under 5 million barrels a day, by the way. And, you know, we didn't know that until it was seen through the, quote, rearview mirror, because it was a few years before the production figures really came in. And we really understood that, yes, in fact, we had produced more in that year than we would ever produce again. And when it became known generally in the world, the other great oil producer that was then ramping up, which was OPEC, which was a combination that included Saudi Arabia and many other Muslim states, as well as some West African states, they seized pricing power. And they started manipulating the prices in ways that were very unfavorable for us. So we had a decade of, you know, all of the things that depended on oil moving up in price, whether it was, you know, the trucking of groceries or moving merchandise around or manufacturing plastic or anything. You know, plus we had this problem with the U.S. oil, the U.S. car industry being geared up for enormous cars. And it took years for them to change that. And in the meantime, they really lost their market share, and they never really quite got it back again. And we also had tremendous financial disruptions with extremely high interest rates of 15-20% towards the late 70s. And, you know, imagine having to pay 18% interest on a mortgage. Well, that was the situation. We also had a high unemployment. The stock market got into trouble. You know, it was generally understood that we were in a lot of in an economic malaise because of this. And the economists referred to it as stagflation, which meant we were stagnant and we were having inflation at the same time because the price of all common goods was going up. So that's the history of the 70s. Now, something happened by the mid-1980s, okay? Are you still with me there?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Starting, you know, in the mid-1980s, we had ramped up oil production in these newly discovered areas of the North Slope of Alaska and the North Sea in Europe, which belonged to England and Norway. And they produced a lot of oil, and they moderated the price considerably. And also, they were two oil-producing regions that were not under the control of OPEC. So that served as a substantial counterbalance to OPEC. Price of oil then started to go down. And so from the mid-80s through the 90s, you get the price of oil consistently going down, and Americans are lulled into this false sense of security that the oil problems of the 1970s were just a big fake, that it was just some shuck and jive that was run on them by big business and the oil sheikhs over in Saudi Arabia and politicians, and they developed this delusional idea that that we could live in a cheap oil society forever. Well, now we're in a situation where the world faces global oil production peak, and that will have very serious consequences of its own. And this time it will be an energy crisis that won't go away. It'll be permanent.
Now, as someone who was actually born the year the U.S. peaked in oil production, I don't remember a lot of coverage of the domestic economic troubles of the
70s. Well, dude, I covered it. I was a newspaper reporter in 1973, and I covered it. I was there on the gas lines with my little reporter's notebook pad. We used to write on paper in those days. You know, we didn't carry notebook computers around. And I watched the people having fistfights on the gas lines, and I saw the economic carnage that was going on, and and I saw it all. And it was for real, dude.
I'm curious if in the mainstream media coverage, which mainstream media then was obviously significantly different than it is today, but I'm curious if at the time the issue of either domestic peak or the loss of U.S. ability to control prices was ever addressed as a reason, as opposed to, oh, those lousy Saudi princes are trying to fleece us?
Well, it was mostly the latter. I don't think the peak was really understood. I do think it was clearly understood that the pricing power had shifted elsewhere. So, that, you know, there was no question about that. But, you know, it was, as you said, people tend to scapegoat and blame. Mm-hmm. And there were two crises, actually, in the 1970s. The second one was in 1979, and it came about as a result of the overthrow of the Shah of Iran. And the Iranian mullahs who took over from him wanted to mess with us, and they did. So they sort of price-jacked us and sent the price of oil skyrocketing again. And anyway, that tended to reinforce the idea that wicked foreigners were messing with us, and that, you know, that was the extent of the problem.
So the North Sea and the North Slope of Alaska come online and provide pricing balance against the Middle East. And,
that's exactly right.
And basically, you know, as you said, fed a delusion that there would be limitless oil forever, and provided basically the foundation for the economic boom of the 90s. The
Absolutely, which was, by the way, based on further suburban expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And the dirty secret of the economy in recent years is that it hasn't been about a new economy. It hasn't been about digital information or services or any of that bull. It's been about the creation of ever more suburban sprawl and the furnishing of it and the accessorizing of it and the servicing of it and supporting the activities associated with it, like real estate sales and mortgage selling and stuff like that. And that's what our economy has been all about. And one of the reasons that we've had such poor political leadership on this set of issues is that no politician wants to come out and say, we can't do suburban sprawl anymore. It's ruining our civilization. So you know, nobody will talk about it, not even the Democrats, not even the so-called progressives.
Right.
So if anyone's wondering why there's no public discussion about our predicament, that's at the heart of the problem.
Well, and even, and we'll get to this again later on, but even in my talking to people I know, you know, people down here at the radio station, Progressive Community Radio, Independent, yep. Fiery Public Affairs, etc., nobody wants to talk about the idea of why are you still driving your car unnecessarily.
Hey, Andrew, look, I got friends in my part of the country who are certainly consider themselves to be both progressives and environmentalists, and they have stickers on their SUVs that say war is not the answer. So, you know, right. I want to clue them in and tell them, you know what, war is the answer. If you're going to live like that, war is the answer. Grow up. Stop complaining.
Now, the question of peak oil is being raised by folks who, in some sense, remind me of the folks that say, well, climate, you know, sure, a couple of thousand scientists have said, yeah, climate change is dangerous and real and here now, and it could be abrupt. But there's a couple folks here and there that say, nah, that's not the case. And the same thing is happening with the concept of peak oil. Now, they're not saying, yeah, there's infinite supply, because let's face it, the Earth is a solid sphere and it has a finite volume. Okay.
Yes, it does not have a creamy nougat
right.
center, as some people think.
Basic physics, finite volume, only so much oil available, appears like we're hitting the halfway production point.
Yep.
And so, you know, let's get to the issue of the folks, and just address this real kind of quickly, because there was a report that came out yesterday that is fueling the idea that, you know, again, peak oil is just some sort of sham that's being run on the oil by the oil industry in collusion with the environmentalists to keep prices high, and it just doesn't make any sense. So Cambridge Energy and Research Associates put a report out yesterday that said, and they don't allow the report to be out on the web, it's just a press release. So what I got from it was they're saying that, you know, we got another 20 years, no sweat. That supply.
Yeah,
I've
seen the report, or I've seen the news reports of the release.
Can you address this issue of
sure.
peak oil,
you know,
doesn't exist?
The report was put out by Cambridge Associates, which is run. It's a consulting group run by Daniel Yergin, who is the author of an excellent history of the mm-hmm. oil industry, a book called The Prize, which is well known.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very good book, and it was turned into a PBS series. Daniel Yergin appears to have, you know. Now I'm going to say something that you know is not going to be easy to swallow, but Daniel Yergin is a consultant to the oil industry, and he has become something of a shill for it. And it's my opinion that he may not be a reliable messenger, that he may be sending out a certain amount of disinformation for the oil industry. Now, I'll say this on just, you know, a policy basis, or at least a substantive basis, is that it seems to me that Jurgen is not taking into account the geopolitical potential for trouble. The fact of the matter is that two-thirds of the world's remaining oil is in the Middle East. It's a turbulent part of the world in which anything can happen, and in which we could be very easily cut off from one way or another. You know, whether tankers were sunk in the Straits of Hormuz, or there was trouble, sabotage in the Saudi Arabian oil fields or refineries or pipelines, or just continued low-grade fourth-generation war, as they call it, in the Arab states, which we are currently engaged in, any number of things. Jurgen doesn't really take that into account. His report assumes that everything is going to be smooth and swell, including geopolitics, and I think that's not something we can at all make assumptions about. You know, the other thing that he seems to assume is that that demand for oil is going to either stay stable or decline. And the only way it's going to decline is if some economic or financial catastrophe, like a crash in the U.S. dollar, propels us into something equivalent to a Great Depression. And, that, you know, that would certainly not be a good state of affairs for the United States either. And it would probably send the price of oil down somewhat, but it wouldn't necessarily make life any more pleasant in the United States. And it would certainly only postpone our reckoning with peak oil, which Jurgen admits that there is a terminal point. He just thinks it's further out than other people.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least he's saying that, and I'm not sure what he really believes. It would be interesting to find out what he really believes.
You're listening to James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency, here on KBOO in Portland. Now, in the past week, or maybe 10 days, there have been a series of news articles that have come out, primarily not U.S. press, but a little bit. Let's see. From Reuters a week ago, BP, British Petroleum, says global oil reserve growth stalled in 2004.
And by the way, it substantially stalled in 2002 and 2003 also. There were no significant discoveries in those calendar years either.
Right. And now this relates to something that energy analyst Matthew Simmons presented at the May 2005 Peak Oil Conference in Portugal. He submitted a paper called Redefining Peak Oil. And he's talking about the it's kind of a complex idea. He yep. basically puts out the idea that, well, maybe we've already hit the peak and we just can't tell, because in the mid-80s, I don't know if it was all of OPEC, but at least most of OPEC, the big producers anyway, their reserves tripled, literally, overnight.
Yeah.
Now, how does something like that happen? Well,
happened because the nationalized oil companies of Saudi Arabia, which is called Aramco, which is the remnant of the American-Arabian partnership that existed before, made up of the American oil companies, and you know, they nationalized it after the 70s and took it over. And their figures are not transparent, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
They are state secrets. Unlike American companies, which have to report to stockholders and the SEC and all sorts of other agencies and make their earnings and numbers and reserves known, the OPEC members do not. So for years, you know, the figures that the Saudis put out was just taken at face value. They said we had X number of reserves, and everybody said, okay, swell. Well, what's happened is, over the last year, as the price of oil has gone up and up from, you know, the $30 range to the $50 to $60 range now, the West has repeatedly asked the Arabians to increase their production. And the Arabians, Aramco specifically, has been unable to increase production, though they repeatedly promised to do it. So the assumption is either they don't want to or they can't. Now, Matthew Simmons is a very important figure in the oil industry. He is the leading investment banker for the American oil industry. He's not a marginal figure. He's a mainstream figure with tremendous authority and legitimacy and credibility. And he has been studying the OPEC and specifically Saudi Arabian situation for many years and is very alarmed about it and has gone around the country giving talks to groups of people, important business people, about this. And he's been studying Saudi production. Saudi production tends to come mostly from one gigantic oil field, the Ghawar oil field, which is now about 30 years old, supplies the majority of Saudi production. And a 30-year-old oil field is an old oil field. They have been struggling to keep production up in it. And in doing it, they've been pumping a lot of seawater into the oil fields to keep the pressure up.
Mm-hmm.
And that has the tendency, as Simmons says, of corroding the oil fields structurally in their geological structure. And half of the liquid that now comes out of the field is seawater, not oil.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some question about, A, whether they have structurally destroyed or impaired or damaged the Ghawar field, the largest oil field ever found, or whether the field is simply past peak, which is very likely because many, many fields do peak after 30 years. That tends to be the precedent. So the bottom line is that the gigantic reserves of Saudi Arabia may not have been as gigantic as they claimed.
Right, and that's a very serious issue because if in fact, and you know, again, this can't be known in real time, it's an after-the-fact kind of thing, but, you know.
Yeah, we will only know in the rearview mirror what was what. And what we're, the information we're getting now, which is we've asked them 11 times to increase production, and 11 times they said they would and didn't, that tends to send a pretty clear message that right. maybe something's going on there.
Right. Now, along with petroleum is often found methane, natural gas.
And
methane. It doesn't fare any better in terms of, well, it can't replace oil in the context of, say, a vehicle fuel, but it could still heat your house. But
no, you can run it in cars. As a matter of fact, you can run it in cars.
It's true, but it's not like we're not set up for that. We're set up for a liquid-based.
Well, we are, and that's true, and it would cost an awful lot to change that out. But there are additional problems with natural gas that are different.
Well, but at the same time, it also is projected to be approaching peak production globally.
Well, I actually think we're a little further out of peak production globally.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little harder to say. The real problem where the United States is concerned is that we're past peak with natural gas in North America.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the reason that's a problem is because you tend to get the natural gas you get from the continent that you're on.
Well, because it's easiest to transport as
well,
a gas.
Well, because it is generally transported around the continent on a pipeline network.
Right.
And if you have to do it otherwise, you have to compress it, refrigerate it to an extremely low temperature, put it in specially built cargo vessels that are actually extremely expensive to build themselves, namely the big tanker ships, and then you have to unload the stuff at terminals where it's regasified and sent back into the pipeline network. And this is all very expensive. Nobody wants to, we don't have very many of these terminals in the United States. We have just a handful of them, and we don't have enough. And nobody wants to have any new ones built near them because they tend to be dangerous.
And there's talk of putting one here in Astoria, Oregon.
Yeah,
out
and
at the end
there
of
has
Columbia.
Been talk about putting one in up around in New England, and one in Nova Scotia, and one down in the Gulf. I think in Louisiana. There already is one in Louisiana, but they need many more of them to make this work. And the natural gas predicament in North America is arguably more ominous than the oil problem, because we may actually encounter major problems with our natural gas supply just in a few years. And half the homes in America are heated with natural gas.
And there was concern about a natural gas emergency, was it two winters ago?
Yeah, we 2003? Had a problem with a very cold winter in the northern U.S. And it put a great strain on the existing supplies. What you get every year is that there's what's called an injection season. they pump a lot of natural gas out of the ground, and they store it underground in caverns and other sites around the country. And then they release it to the other into the pipeline network during the winter when it's needed. And in that year, I think it was 2003, when it came to be late February, March, it had been so cold, so extraordinarily, supernaturally cold, that we'd gone through a lot of our natural gas for the year. Mm-hmm. And there was a great deal of worry that that the pressure would drop in the natural gas pipelines all around America, and that in itself would lead to a chain of very difficult problems, like furnaces going out and furnaces not being able to restart. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I live in a house with a gas stove and a gas furnace.
Yeah, well, beats me many of us do. I do myself.
Yeah, I don't know how to restart the pilot.
Right. Many people don't. And only the newest furnaces restart automatically. You know, the older ones that were built in the 1970s or 80s, you actually have to relight them. And so there was this fear that the pipeline pressure would drop, the furnaces would go out, and then the pilots would remain on, and there would be explosions all over, because it's never happened before.
Right.
It's never happened in the U.S. that the pressure has fallen so low in the pipeline network that furnaces went out in great numbers.
And in a sense, in a neighborhood, it just takes one of the houses.
Right.
Yeah.
So there were very portentous implications to this. We were lucky that time. We sort of got away. We slipped out we slipped through the winter with just by the skin of our teeth on that one. But there's no telling what will happen again. And as a sidebar, the price of natural gas in the units that it's measured in, which is, I think 1,000 cubic feet per unit or something like that, went up to, more than doubled, and has remained more than doubled and gone up, so that it was in the $3 range back in 2003, and now it's in the $7 range.
Well, now, for someone who thinks about things like this on a reasonably regular basis, the issue of oil dependence and peak oil really brings forward the extremely complex and fragile infrastructure, transportation, food production, home heating, and, kind of daily consumables that we all want or need. It's sort of a tenuous kind of a thing.
And we're in trouble.
Yeah, and so let's, we've talked for a half of the show about kind of background and some of the financial and politics, and let's spend the other part of the hour talking about your ideas on what this is going to mean in terms of daily life. This is really the last two chapters of your book, The Long Emergency. Chapter 6, Running on Fumes, The Hallucinated Economy. And then the last one, Living in the Long Emergency.
Yeah.
So the economy, the economy is sort of assumed as that's what you do with your time. You're supposed to participate in the economy as a producer, as a consumer. And, when people meet, one of the first questions is often, what do you do? Which means, how do you earn money?
Right.
Because that's...
I don't think any of these things are really bizarre or strange. Having a vocation or a job, as we say, or a profession, has certainly been part of life for 1,000 years.
Yeah, you've got to do something with
years.
Your time.
That's not a new thing. And, buying stuff that people have made and getting household goods and procuring your food and things to cook it in and all that, that's also not a new thing in the world. But the hyper-turbo state of the consumer economy that we've cranked up is a fairly a perverted and kind of distorted version of the way people have lived for traditionally, and it's going to be a problem.
As you call it, the high entropy economy.
Yeah. And, there are several implications to this. One is that circumstances, namely a lower energy, is going to compel us to live differently, whether we like it or not. One of the great arguments in favor of the suburban consumer way of life in recent years has been the idea that it must be good because people like it, and that it only represents one choice among many other choices. You know, you can live suburban, you can live in the city, you can live, you know, a small town, blah, blah, blah. I think what we'll see is that it's going to be less and less of a viable choice for people. And whether they like it or not, we're going to have to make other arrangements. We are going to have to downscale and rescale and resize and rearrange all the important activities of daily life in America, including farming, how we produce food, including how we do schooling, including how we do retail trade, how we live in relation to other things and other people. We could start with food production. Terribly important. It's really at the heart of the issue, and people take it for granted because the cheap oil fiesta of the last half century has led people to think that food is created in supermarkets,
right?
And
they're always full.
And they're always full of fantastic selections and arrays of products. Well, in fact, you know, food comes out of the ground, and we've been very successful at pouring oil on the ground, so to speak, and putting on the natural gas-based fertilizers and the oil-based pesticides and herbicides and getting massive crops of corn and turning them into cheese doodles and Pepsi-Cola. And that's been the model for agriculture for America for a long time. You know, the cheese doodle, Pepsi-Cola, Archer Daniel Midland, corporate, giant-scaled, petroleum-based farming thing.
Right.
That's not going to do so well in the years to come, the years just ahead. It's going to falter. It's probably going to fail. We're probably going to have to grow a lot more of our food close to home, and we are not prepared for that. The subdivision practices of the last 50 years have been tremendously destructive to the integrity of the landscape. So there's a great deal of question about how we're even going to reallocate land for local agriculture,
right?
Or who is going to do it? There's going to be a whole new class of people in this country called the formerly middle class. People who will lose jobs and incomes and vocations who will never get them back again. They're going to be very angry and aggrieved and bewildered by the loss of their entitlements to the easy motoring way of life. A lot of them may end up one way or another working in the new agriculture because it's going to require a lot more human labor than it did before. You know, we don't know exactly what that means. You know, right now, less than 2% of the American people work in connection with food production on the land.
Mm-hmm.
But in the future, that may be 5% or 13% or 38%. We really don't know yet. But it's liable to be higher, whatever it is. And we don't know what the social arrangements are going to be between the people who work on the land and the people who own the land. They may be very fraught with grievance and resentment.
Well, and additionally, you bring up the idea, and it's not like you coined the idea, but you point out that we could potentially revert to a sort of feudal society where
I say social relations, I mean, you know, people may trade their allegiance mm-hmm. and their personal sovereignty, in other words, their ability to make decisions about their own lives in exchange for the security of food and physical security.
Mm-hmm.
That may occur. We don't know. My point generally is simply we don't know what the social relations are going to be, and we take for granted that we're a modern, progressive civilization. Well, circumstances could change that very rapidly, and we could be thrust back into social relations that we have not seen for decades or maybe even centuries. Especially where, you know, the ownership of land is concerned and the work that people do on it.
You're listening to James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. And you can find out more about him online at www.kunstler.com. That's K-U-N-S-T-L-E-R. And there's all manner of links related to the topic of the show today at the People Rise Up website, found at kboo.fm. So, yeah, I mean, food production is sort of, if nothing else is resolved, that has to be, you know, how we're going to deal with that.
It's going to change a lot of things, Andrew. You know, one thing it'll change is there will have to be a restoration of the idea that urban life and rural life are not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Those boundaries were pretty much erased by the fiasco of our suburban project in the last half century. And in the future, people are not going to be able to lead an urban life in the rural setting, which is kind of the idea that is behind suburbia. You know, that you can be an advertising executive and live 40 miles outside of town on a little farmette mm-hmm. and be connected to your livelihood by the umbilical cord of your SUV. These relations are going to change, and probably in the future, if you opt for the rural life, you'd probably better be prepared to lead a rural lifestyle and follow a rural vocation. So that will also call into question the quality of our towns and you know the traditional human habitats of towns and villages and even cities, because more people will be returning to the urban habitat. Now, I happen to think that the cities, as we know them now, will probably contract. And this is, you know, I don't think I'm contradicting myself if you understand what it is I mean mm-hmm. specifically. The cities, I think, will probably densify at their centers, but the suburban asteroid belts around them are probably going to lose their utility and, to some extent, be abandoned. Maybe not completely, but incrementally, they're going to become less valuable, less useful, and less lived in. And I think the bigger cities are going to be in bigger trouble, especially the cities that are overburdened with megastructures and skyscrapers, because these buildings may not be easy to run in a low-energy economy without liberal supplies of natural gas, especially, and without a reliable electric grid. If we start living in a country where we have more frequent brownouts and blackouts, which is very possible with the natural gas situation, mm-hmm. since so much of our electricity is generated with gas, that we're going to have trouble running these large buildings. And New York and Chicago especially will present problems. So I think the action is going to be in the smaller towns and the smaller cities, and most certainly in the places that are close to viable agriculture. The places that are not, places like Phoenix and Tucson and Las Vegas, are literally going to dry up and blow away. I believe that you will see these places substantially depopulated.
Well, and it's interesting because what we refer to as the Great Plains in the United States have been depopulated in the 20th century to the point that the population density in many of the counties of the plains are equal to what they were in the 1880s, the frontier days. Different
farming
reasons.
On the Great Plains has been really on the outer Great Plains, the more arid part of the West, mm-hmm. like Nebraska and Western Iowa and Nebraska, Colorado, Montana. That's been disappointing. And, the heyday of the Great Plains was really the very early 20th century. And since then, it's become increasingly problematic. I think that part of the United States and the Rocky Mountains are probably also not going to be very propitious places for life after the long emergency or in the long emergency.
Okay, I was trying to figure out which direction to go here. You do separate out by geographic region the outlook of the long emergency, and you note that the Pacific Northwest seems like it will fare better than other regions, but possibly not the best. Portland certainly has its own suburban blight and sprawl problem, although it
has... major cities do. Yeah, you know, Portland did a better job with the center of its city than many other places. You know, certainly been more fortunate than St. Louis or Detroit or Kansas City, you know. But
and there's a vibrant farming community here, small-scale farms and farmer markets. And by the way, there's one today downtown in the Park Blocks. And, you know, that, you know, I feel somewhat fortunate, assuming I stay here, that, you know, it's like, okay, well, I happen to end up in a region that we may be able to do better, you know, than other parts of the country.
I hope that 15 million Californians don't decide that would be a good place to go too.
Well, but all the same, you know, you can't, if oil's expensive or unavailable, then, you know, living even 10 miles out, you know, it's like, okay, so you figure you're riding a bike, you're walking, you're carpooling somehow. You know, distances that don't seem like any big deal in a car suddenly take on, you know, significant portion of your day.
Well, that's true. I hasten to point out that in the places where it is possible, what you'll probably see is the restoration of, much closer nodes of centrality, commerce. You know, where I live, that's a very sort of complex way to put it, but where I live, for example, in upstate New York, prior to the automobile, we had established, agricultural trading towns and villages that were on the average about 7-8 miles apart. Mm-hmm. If you go there today, a lot of the smaller ones have completely fallen apart. You know, the storefronts have been empty for 30 years. There's no business there. People all drive 60 miles to the Walmart, and they don't think anything of it. But these places are liable to see a kind of renaissance of agriculture and a renewal of the little villages that the infrastructure is still there for them to reform, and they probably will. In the newer parts of the country, like, you know, the far west, the northwest, Oregon, you may see, new nodal centers pop up where they hadn't been before and, you know, form around agricultural regions. You know, I hasten to add that an awful lot of the northwest is not good ag land. You know, a lot of it's desert,
mm-hmm.
You know, especially once you get beyond the mountains east of Portland, for example, or
right.
Seattle, for that matter.
Right.
And you mainly have those areas, around the coast, the Willamette Valley, and so on. Those they're wonderful agricultural areas, but they're somewhat limited.
Well, and to the extent they've not been organically farmed, they may have issues related to soil health, tilth.
That'll be an issue all over America.
Yeah.
Well, that's for everybody. It's not, you're not special.
And then there's the connected issue of loss of knowledge. You know, I mean, I believe you point out very early on in The Long Emergency that there's basically no one alive today that remembers what it was like to live without plentiful cheap oil.
Well, that's true. I do think that there is plenty of knowledge out there, but not everybody who wants to work in agriculture is going to be able to just go out and do it. You know, I know an awful lot of people who around here who, you know, think they're going to go out and get farms or farmettes and succeed in being farmers. Well, the fact is they know almost nothing about it. And I know people who actually did know quite a bit about it and went out and tried to do it and had a very hard time. So it's not mm-hmm. something you could just go out and do overnight.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be a problem.
So,
you know, there's something I think we ought to talk about,
uh-huh.
or at least I ought to blab about, because you didn't ask me about it, and it is important. A lot of people out there are probably wondering or thinking, well, we have all these alternative fuels, and they are going mm-hmm. to rescue us, are they not? And that is a very important question.
Hey, I heard that there's alternative fuels that are going to rescue us, like biodiesel and
right.
like hydrogen, which isn't really an energy source. What about those?
Well, the basic equation is that no combination of alternative fuels or systems for running them is going to allow us to continue running the interstate highway system in Walt Disney World, or for that matter, American life as we're currently running it.
Can we have one of them?
Huh?
Can we have one of them?
We're going to have all of them. We're going to do them. We're going to do everything we possibly can. We're going to use alternative fuels and systems. It's just that people are overly optimistic about it. They're somewhat delusional about it. They are not going to replace what we have been enjoying. We will use wind and we will use solar, but we're probably going to have to do it at a much smaller scale than people are imagining. I'm thinking the household and neighborhood scale or municipal scale at the most. Mm-hmm. We are going to be using, you know, things like biodiesel, but in a much more limited way than people are imagining. I ran into the biodiesel enthusiasts about 6 weeks ago when I gave a lecture at Middlebury College in Vermont, and they came up to me afterwards and they were kind of ticked off at me, and they said, "Oh, you're dissing our program. You know, you're not being fair about it." And I asked them a few things, you know, because they have all these high hopes about biodiesel saving America. I said, "Has it occurred to you guys that when our current method of raising food falters, that we're probably going to have to devote a lot more of our land to human food production, because our crop yields are going to go way down when we stop pouring oil and gas on the corn?" And they said, "Oh, dude, we hadn't really thought about that." You know, and I said, "You know, you realize that we're probably going to be using more working animals. I don't know how many more. I don't know whether it's 3% more or 38% more, but it's going to be more. And we're going to have to grow food for them. So that's going to cut into your biodiesel fuel production. Have you ever thought of that?" "Oh, no, dude, we hadn't thought of that." So, you know, I don't want to, like, be cruel to these people, but the fact is they very naively have assumed that exactly the same conditions are going to prevail as today, you know, only they're going to sort of bring biodiesel into it. Instead of growing corn for cheese doodles, Archer Daniel Midland will grow it for biodiesel. Mm-hmm. Well, that ain't going to happen. You know, it ain't going to happen. Some people will produce some of it, and there will be some. But, you know, it's similar to the idea that we're going to take all the used French fried potato oil from all the fast food places in America and run the interstate highway system on biodiesel cars. You know,
right? Well, it's just that people. It's such a big prospect.
Yeah, it's hard for them to process.
And it's just tough to imagine. I mean, these are some things that I've been thinking about recently in the context of this, mostly related to food, because I like to eat.
Yeah, most people do.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm making a simple burrito: beans, rice, lettuce, tomato, salsa, tortilla.
Yeah. Third world lunch.
Yeah. So, and I'm thinking, it's like, okay, well, you know, where am I going to get tortillas? You know, it's like, well, they grow a lot of wheat in Eastern Oregon, but like, how's wheat going to get here?
Well, that's right. It may be a problem. It may be quite a problem.
And, you know, it's just...
And I certainly can't answer that question except to say, we can't be optimistic and naive about the answer.
So what would you suggest folks begin to do? I mean, you're not calling for, you know, go buy yourself a farmette and, you know, get your 2 acres and make a go of it. That's not that you're not saying that at all. In fact, that seems
no,
sort
my
of
book
against
is not a survival manual
right.
for people. It's a description of what we're heading into and kind of a warning about it.
Well, but you think about this stuff a lot. You must have come up with some, you know, learning to garden, learning to grow food. Obviously, among the first suggestions
I think an addition thing of additional importance is to make sure that you place yourself somewhere that has some reasonable prospects for success. You know, I still run into people all the time who tell me they're moving to Tucson or moving to Phoenix. You know, I tell them I think they're crazy. And I tell them exactly why. Not a wise thing to do. Those places don't have good prospects because on top of energy problems, they're going to have water problems. They're going to have probably conflict with Mexico because as America suffers economically, Mexico will suffer by another order of magnitude, and a lot of people will leave. I think that being part of a community, a viable, cohesive community, is terribly important. And that's one of the reasons I think that small towns are probably going to do better in the future than the cities are. And this would be not that supernaturally strange. It would only be kind of a reversal of trends we've seen in the last 100 years. And that's not the most, that's not the weirdest thing that's ever happened in the world. Trends reverse. You know, for 100 years, people have been moving from small towns and farms to cities. Well, we're about to go through a major reversion. And probably a period of fairly turbulent population movements. So being part of a community is very important. Rethinking your vocation or job, because there are going to be some kinds of lines of work that are not going to be meaningful 20 years from now. If you're a 20-year-old college student, you know, taking a major in public relations probably ain't such a hot idea, you know, or marketing or something geared towards a hyper-turbo consumer economy. Not a good idea. Finding hands-on, useful things to do, probably a good idea. You know, I think certain kinds of very fundamental mechanical engineering will be very important, because we're going to have to retool a lot of the things that we do and make them local, whether it's energy production in the form of restoring small hydro sites or small wind operations or you know, something like that, or activities associated with agriculture. Things that are sometimes called value-added activities, like, you know, making cheese, making wine, you know, producing bread, running bakeries. These things are all going to be terribly important on the local level. Around my part of the world, which was big into dairying in the turn of the century, when the electric milking machine came about, mm-hmm. and bulk refrigeration. You know, we used to have a lot of local creameries that dealt with the milk production, and they've all disappeared. They'll come back. You know, they may be even more local than they were in 1920. They may have to be closer together because of the refrigeration problem. So those kinds of things I think people would benefit from thinking about. Hands-on jobs, things that are going to make them useful to their fellow citizens and perhaps incidentally earn them a living.
Well, and additionally, then there's the issue of, well, earning a living, trade. I mean, if you can, I mean, even if it's craft and it's not, you know, you're a basic level mechanical engineer,
sure.
artisan
yeah,
trades.
Yeah, I think we're going to be entering a period of when artisan activities are very important. And you know, for example, sooner or later, the 12,000-mile supply lines to Walmart from China are not going to be working for us, you know. Mm-hmm. How are we going to get household products? Well, we don't know. Fact is, right. We don't know. I think we can safely conjecture that we're not going to get the factories of 1920 up and running again.
Right.
We're not going to relive the 20th century. Many of the factories from from that period in my area have been bulldozed already. They stopped working in 1970, and now they've been bulldozed. So they're not even there anymore.
You still with us? Okay. You cut out there for a second.
I had a call waiting thing on my phone, but I'm going to just ignore it for a moment. Calls into question how we're going to make household goods. And I think the answer is probably on a much more limited basis, perhaps on a cottage industry basis. We will probably have far fewer things to buy. Shopping or being a, quote, consumer will probably fade much more into the background of our daily life than it has for, you know, 20, 30 years or more.
And there's just certain stuff we will perish the thought,
do without. Yeah, we just may do without salad shooters.
Right. I mean, all of our grandparents were perfectly fine without all manner of plastic stuff.
Yes, without salad shooters and believe it or not, even though I like them, they did without the Cuisinart food processor. They managed to do without it somehow.
Right.
They did without things like silly putty and Mr. Potato Head and all kinds of things that we have cluttering up our basements and attics.
Just lastly, do you feel like the process of the long emergency will force people to adjust the time scale or the way in which they view time, people, society, because there's so much the focus in business anyway, the next quarter or...
Oh God, yeah. I mean, you know, it's going to turn our culture upside down and inside out, and there will be many changes in our values, in the things that we consider are important, or the way we go about doing things on a daily basis. Now, I'm not a religious person, but I think that belonging to churches is probably going to become a much more common thing, even for the so-called progressives. You know, the secularists of our time, I think, will find themselves probably involved in church activities because that may be one of the few institutions that have legitimacy that are left,
mm-hmm.
You know, in which people can find a framework for civic action. And it may become the locus of that. We don't know. Many of the social enactments of the past and the ceremonial social stuff of the past that we've left behind... And replaced with television, will probably return. You know, people having meals together more. You know, probably half the population of the United States has their meals by popping something in a microwave oven. You know, that's going to change. The way we do work, shoulder to shoulder, you know, in the future, in a meaningful way with our neighbors, is going to be a big change. So I think we're in for tremendous changes, and we're going to, you know, we have been a brave, resourceful, and generous people in the past, and I think we'll bring it to this emergency that we face, this long emergency.
All right. Well, let's hope so. James Howard Kunstler has been my guest this morning. He is the author of, in addition to other books, most recently, The Long Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Andrew, a pleasure to be here.
All right. Take care.
Okay, dude. Bye-bye.
Bye. And you can find out more about him online at www.kunstler.org. That's K-U-N-S-T-L-E-R. I'm sorry, not .org, .com. And again, People Rise Up website at kboo.fm has all manner of links related to today's program. I appreciate you listening. If you got any questions or comments, you can give me a call down here at the station, 231-8187, 503 area code. Email is kboo@riseup.net, and you can send mail here to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214.